From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, it's day one for the MBTA's new general manager, Luis Ramirez.
And this morning, I took the Green Line in to work, and the affair machines weren't working.
And as the North Shore Music Theater gets ready to open its production of Evita this fall, one group wants to know, where are all the Latin actors?
Acting isn't just pretending. It's also drawing upon who you are. And if you're playing a character from a culture that you aren't, then what are you drawing from? You're drawing from stereotypes.
Plus,
this morning, police also arrested one of the two suspects they were looking for in connection with the shooting of Tiffany Moore. 23-year-old Sean Drumgold was nabbed in Roxbury District Court.
Drumgold served 14 years in prison for that murder, a murder he did not commit. Journalist Dick Lehrer tells a version of this true story in his new YA novel. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's the first day on the job for the MBTA's new general manager. Luis Ramirez said a bit earlier today that he was greeted with what can only be described as a typical writer experience at Heinz Convention Center.
This morning I took the Green Line in to work, and the affair machines weren't working.
We've all been there. Well, Ramirez did take some questions from a small group of Boston journalists, including me and my colleague Kathleen McNerney, who's here in the studio now. Hello, Kathleen.
Hi, Meghna.
So it's day one.
Yeah, day one, first day, really high-profile job, lots of public scrutiny, and it's really different in that respect, in many respects, from his previous experience at Siemens, GE, and Global Power Equipment. Saying that having the Green Line fare box not working really drove home to him that the experiences that customers are having often on a daily basis, which is why he said that one of his top priorities for the first 6 months is that he's going to be extremely customer focused.
Working with customers and making customers the center of what we're trying to do is really what I'm going to work on here. So it's very important for me to capture their voice and to drive what they're telling me and what I need to hear from them to be able to effectively do my job as a leader of the MBTA.
And as he said to the Globe last week and again today, that he's going to hire a senior customer experience executive at the T to help him do just that.
Yeah, now this is really interesting because, yes, Luis Ramirez has said he's going to be very focused on customer experience, but technically the MBTA already has a customer experience group,
right?
And improving the writer experience has been a major goal of the Fiscal Management Control Board for a while. And in fact, just last December in 2016, the T hired a chief customer experience officer, a job that sounds a lot like idea that Luis Ramirez had. And that person did report to the GM. So we asked him today, so how does his idea on focusing on customer experience differ from what's already in place at the T?
Today's my first day, so I don't know what was done before, but I will tell you that until I hire a customer service person for my staff, which I plan to do, I'm kind of doing that job myself.
Now, we should say that we spoke to Luis Ramirez, did this press conference around midday today, and afterwards, MassDOT got back to us and told us that the person who was in the customer experience office, that executive, is no longer actually with the T, the person who'd been hired in December 2016, and that Luis Ramirez will, quote, be hiring someone who will work directly with him on customer service, and that position's job description will be written this week in consultation with Mr. Ramirez and other T officials.
Right. So the question that we'll be looking at is how that position does or doesn't change and what it actually means for customers. The devil's always in the details. But this still appears to be one of the core principles for Ramirez. He brought it up time and time again. In addition to riding the rails and the bus lines today, he says that over the past few weeks, he's visited a lot of the T facilities, and he said that he's really a hands-on manager.
You'll see me out there quite a bit. I really want to get to know every site. I'm the kind of guy that really likes to walk the shop, and that's why I learn about the organization, and that's what I'm going to be doing.
So he'll really be the public face of the T to both employers and customers, which is really great. It also reminded me about the last publicly traded company that he led, Global Power Equipment Group in Texas.
Right, because as we were the first report here, shortly after Luis Ramirez left that company in 2015, Global Power said that it found some major accounting errors in its books, and it ended up having to resubmit financial filings to the SEC for the years 2011 through 2014, and three of those years and Luis Ramirez was there between 2012 and 2015. Now those errors, some of them came before Ramirez's time at Global Power, for folks catching up to this part of the story, but they also continued throughout his tenure. And as a result, Luis Ramirez is still facing a shareholder lawsuit from shareholders of Global Power, and the SEC is also investigating what exactly happened. So a lot of financial challenges at Luis Ramirez's former company, maybe even bankruptcy, which is interesting because today, once again, when questioned, the MBTA's new GM really defended his record as being a turnaround specialist, and he defended his time at Global Power.
Well, when you're doing a turnaround, it's not just about the numbers. It's also about creating systems and processes that actually identify issues and help to improve the process long term. So as I said before, I can't really comment on that because of the litigation that's going on, but I will say that I stand behind my record, and the growth and the things that we achieved were achieved as a result of all the things that we did while I was there.
Now, Kathleen, we should say that the reason why he said that is because I had asked, he talked about how Global Power's revenues had gone up
right.
while he was there. But if you look further down their balance sheet, their net income went way down and their earnings per share for shareholders also went way down. But then, you know, about what he knew and didn't know as CEO of Global Power, I directly asked him today, and here's what I asked.
And just for clarity's sake, did you know about the accounting issues that were Global Power was having while you were CEO?
No, I did not.
So, I mean, again, he's facing a lawsuit and an SEC investigation. But it's interesting because, Kathleen, as you were just saying, he talks about himself as a really hands-on manager. So it's kind of a couple different sides of this issue.
And I think that's the big question that we're grappling with, and hopefully the SEC can get to the bottom of, is that, you know, there's allegations in this lawsuit that he was very hands-on. So, and he's here today saying that he's that type of boots on the ground type of manager. So, you know, the big question is, if you're that involved, how did you not know that this was going on? Did you just trust the people underneath you? And I think those are some of the questions that we're hopefully going to find out in maybe the months ahead.
Yeah, exactly. But then, you know, he did talk about how he's bringing a lot of his, well, the totality of his private sector business experience to the MBTA.
Right. And I was really struck by the type of language that he used and this lens that he's bringing to the T. You know, it's a sign of his experience at a lot of these big companies. Here's just one example. When he was talking about his commute this morning, we mentioned the fare machines at Heinz were down. And here's what he said.
That really indicates to me firsthand what are some of the experiences that customers are actually having and why it's so important that we bring their kind of experience into how we operate the business, how we set the metrics up for the business and the teams, and how we also drive the changes that we got to make.
Now, look, no one's going to deny that customer service and customer experience is important. But, you know, there's still this long-term question. And some people, when he was first named, were concerned that he didn't have that much experience in public sector services and public sector goods.
Yeah, and I think you hear, you know, him talking about the business and the metrics, and maybe that is just what the T needs at this moment, is an outsider looking in, but also needs sort of the depth of knowledge about transit systems as a whole.
Mm. Well, he also talked about how he really wanted to address reliability issues at the T. I mean, this is all great for writers to hear, underlying problems at the T, and he wanted to bring, you know, a lot of solutions or a lot of fixes to the T with speed. And here's how he said he might accomplish that.
And innovation, technology, creativity, and those type of things are going to really play a role as I look at the long-term objectives of the MBTA.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really different language and focus than what we've heard from other GMs in the past.
But the governor did say he wants a turnaround CEO, right?
Right. So in that respect, it's not all that surprising. And you know, I think Governor Baker prides himself on being very detail-oriented and sort of focused on the inner workings and of the government.
Yeah. So, Kathleen, we've been following this story for a long time.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, obviously the T is a huge organization with a lot of problems. But as we were just saying a little earlier, one of the concerns is that this new GM, Luis Ramirez, doesn't have any experience in transit whatsoever. But as to whether or not he can turn it around, I mean, just yesterday, on the show, we were talking about a private sector-led turnaround at Bridgewater State Hospital that's wildly successful right now. I mean, they're accomplishing great things there in just a course of 5 months. So I'm not sure it's necessarily like, can a private sector person pull this off? Because we're seeing that turnarounds can happen right at Bridgewater
right,
State.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the big question and tension is that it's possible, but I think people are worried because the public transit is such a different animal. And I think that a lot of people want somebody who really has the depth of knowledge and experience. It's Ramirez's first day. Maybe he can get up to speed. Maybe he's a quick study. And I think we'll have to give him the benefit of the doubt and we'll see starting on Monday when he goes to the Fiscal Management Control Board meeting.
Yeah. I mean, so at Bridgewater State, we have someone right there right now leading it who technically works for a private company, but she has like 20 years of experience in that field of services for people suffering with mental illness. They also had a lot more money given to them by the legislature.
Right.
And every important stakeholder came together and said, we got to fix this problem. At the T, there's always a debate over whether or not they need more money. The stakeholders are often at each other's throats.
Yeah.
And again, Luis Ramirez has never worked on transit, so he's got quite a mountain to climb in front of him.
It's a tall order, and there's a lot of public scrutiny. So
yeah.
We'll see.
We're just doing our jobs, folks. Kathleen McNerney, Radio Boston producer, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Magna.
All right. Well, sitting quietly and patiently next to you, Kathleen, is the marvelous Evan Horowitz. He writes the quick study column for the Boston Globe, and he's with us now. Hi there, Evan.
Hey, Magna. How are you?
And you've also covered the Luis Ramirez story as
I
well.
I have, which is why it's taken all my restraint not to jump in.
So jump in now.
Well, no, I just love the idea that sort of turning this around involves innovation, technology, and creativity. That's the kind of trio that gets you a failing grade at a business school. You know, we need something more detailed than that. And I guess I'm just still sort of waiting.
We're waiting, yes. I mean, again, he did say multiple times that this is his first. Mr. Ramirez said this is his first day in a sector he's never worked in.
I do agree that, right, it's not necessarily a private sector, public sector thing. It does happen. You get people who are great lights in the private sector who turn out to be great lights in the public sector. Sometimes you get a Mike Bloomberg. Other times you get a Donald Trump. And you don't know. Which is going to be the question isn't so much a private sector, public sector crossover. It's about competence and ability, and that's what we're waiting to see. And, you know, I've never met the man. I did read through incredible reports of his time at Global Power, and I was disturbed by them.
Well, right. I mean, and you're not the only one. Lots of people we've spoken to found what happened at Global Power troubling. And just you're writing about something else, Evan.
Okay,
I'm going to
okay.
get to that in a second. But also, it just occurs to me that Luis Ramirez has another particular challenge. He's surrounded by at least three people who've had his job before, two on the Fiscal Management Control Board. Dan Grabowski is coming back in to sort of set things straight at commuter rail. He's got a very knowledgeable Secretary of Transportation in Stephanie Pollack, and of course Governor Baker, who has strong ideas of what he wants. So like he's got 100 bosses. That can't be easy for him.
No, I don't envy him that, and it may be one of the reasons that the search has been so difficult to find the right person who wants to take a job, a very high profile job, where your autonomy and authority is limited by so many other bosses. But he's jumped for this job, so I think we should measure him on his ability to do it.
And we shall see what happens. Okay, so let's switch gears now, if I can use a mechanical metaphor here, because really why we are delighted that you're with us is that today you've been writing about new U.S. Census numbers that just came out, national numbers on household income, poverty rate, and health insurance. So is there good news for us on this front?
There's mostly good news. Look, it's National Census Day. For those of you who didn't know, it's a very exciting day for those of us in the wonk world who wait for this once a year. I know, you know, you probably hear about like income numbers all the time. Oh, this came out. But the census numbers are the definitive annual numbers, right? They come out this week and they tell us how households in the middle are doing, right?
Yeah.
And households in the middle did pretty well in 2016. Incomes for the median household grew about 3%. Last year, that in 2015, they grew about 5%. That makes the 2015-2016 year the best two-year spurt in terms of income growth since the 1960s. That's really good news.
I'm hearing the sound of thousands of politicians patting themselves on the back right now. But okay, so the absolute numbers seem to show a significant uptick. But, you know, people, I don't think they are feeling any better off.
Well, I hope they're feeling a little better off.
Okay, but maybe
true,
a little.
There are a lot of reasons, and there are a lot of reasons not to feel better off. I mean, there's some surprises in the numbers, too. One is that household incomes are up. Great. Earnings aren't up. Well, wait, how is that possible that individuals aren't earning more, but households are getting more money? That seems very strange. There's an explanation for it, which is that more people in those households are working, mm-hmm. and they're working longer. So if you work more hours, and if somebody else in your family gets a job, your household will get more money. But nobody's getting raises, which should also be happening if the economy is really growing quickly. It doesn't seem to be happening.
And so what about when we drill down into factors like race, geography? Is everybody feeling the same sort of bump?
Same story, sort of good news, bad news. The good news really is the racial breakdown. Virtually every racial group saw an increase in median household income. Black households saw an increase of like 5.7%, gigantic increase. Hispanic households over 4%, but also white non-Hispanic households and Asian households. So there is no real racial differentiation. Geographically, though, there is. You're better off in an urban core as opposed to a rural area. That's obviously a widening divide in America. Didn't seem to have turned around at all in 2016.
More about gender.
So I think this was, for me, sort of the most interesting little twist in the story. The gender pay gap, which has been, you know, the just focus of attention for a long time now, shrunk. You know, women caught up a little bit.
Nobody
in terms
can see
of
my
equality.
Raised eyebrows yeah. of surprise.
Wait, really? yeah. Except it's not great news. I mean, this is what we want, a path towards pay equality. Except the reason they caught up isn't that women got paid a lot more in 2016 than they had been in 2015. It's that men's pay went down.
Huh.
And in fact, this is what's been going on for the last 10 years or so. The wage gap is closing because men are earning less and women are earning just a little bit more.
Wow. Okay. So that's definitely not good news overall then. Absolutely. No, go ahead.
No, I mean, it's hard to know exactly what to take away. You could, the census numbers could be a lot worse than this. You could have poverty going up. You could have household incomes. I mean, this happened in 2008, 2009. The economy looked terrible. What we have now is mostly blue skies with some menacing clouds. I'd rather there weren't menacing clouds. But I'll take the blue skies for the moment.
But Evan, how does this actually compare? I mean, this is you're looking at 2015, 2016 numbers, but you mentioned 2008 and the economic cataclysm that year represented. Are these figures of household income, wages, et cetera, have they fully rebounded to pre-2008?
No. We're still mostly waiting. There's been some mixed reporting on this for technical reasons. But basically, the household income numbers are still slightly below where they were in 2007, just before the recession, and still substantially below where they were in 1999, in the Clinton boom years. So the other Clinton, the one we don't talk about anymore. So what this means is that things are getting better, but we're still way below where we were in 1999. And this is for your household in the middle,
right?
That's really what we're talking about. Middle-class households, people right in the middle of the distribution, they haven't seen any gains in 20 years.
Well, and this is truly, a sobering news because it makes it, you know, a lost couple of decades for middle-income Americans, as you're saying. But we know that it didn't take long after 2008 for the top 1% to regain, you know, what they had lost plus some.
Yeah. So a lot of this money is flowing up. Money's not supposed to flow up. Everything's supposed to trickle. No, it is flowing up, and the 1% are taking a huge amount of the gains. But it's not impossible. This is not an economic inevitability.
Right.
It really is possible to have broad-based wage gains, and we could be doing more to that end.
Okay. So then, I mean, I know that you are our data guy and our wonk guy, but I'm going to drift into politics a little tiny bit here. Who gets to pat themselves on the back? Is this sort of the late-stage momentum from policies put into place by the Obama administration? Or, you know, does Donald Trump get to say a certain amount of these changes happened because he took office in January?
Well, it can't be Donald Trump because this is all from 2016.
So, details, I mean,
you need like a time machine. I'm imagining the scenario. No, so probably not. But
I don't write the wrong quote.
Even President Obama probably shouldn't be patting himself on his back, at least not for this. You want to think about the Federal Reserve. They probably have the most influence on economic cycles in this way. And they kept monetary policy very loose for a very long time, which enabled a recovery, the middling recovery that we have. They could keep it looser for even longer. I think you would get a better labor market and more wage gains. They're fighting about that right now. But I think, you know, if anybody gets credit for getting this far, it's the Fed.
Wow. Okay. So one more thing before we go, Evan. We didn't talk about health insurance. What do the numbers say? Because Massachusetts gets to claim the lowest uninsured rate in the nation again.
Yet again. It is something we can be justly proud of. It is a long legacy here because we started before everybody else doing Romney Care before it became the national model for President Obama and Obamacare. And it's the reason that the uninsurance rate in the state is under 3%. Very impressive. It's a sign that if you do it right and you put the money into it, you really can get close to universal health care using market principles. On the other hand, no other country even really needs to measure these things. Other advanced countries, everybody has health insurance. You don't have to figure out how many people are uninsured. Nobody's uninsured. So there's a little bit of a mixed bag there, too.
Evan, you always bring that very thorny context to these data stories.
I do my best.
Well, Evan Horowitz writes the quick study column for the Boston Globe. It is always great to talk to you, Evan. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Megna.
We'll be back. I'm Megna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This fall, the North Shore Music Theater plans to put on a production of the classic Andrew Lloyd Webber musical, Evita. Now, Evita is largely based on the life of Argentine First Lady Eva Perón. The fact that none of the principal actors in this production, though, are Argentine or Latin or Latino or Latina at all is upsetting to some in the theater world, and they're planning to protest the North Shore Music Theater. Joining us now is Lauren Viegas, founder of Project Am I Right. They say they want an end to the whitewashing, quote, whitewashing of roles written for people of color, people with disabilities, and transgender people, and they're leading the effort against the North Shore Music Theater. And Lauren joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Also with us is Bill Haney, owner of the North Shore Music Theater and producer of its new production of Evita. Bill, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you both. Lauren, first of all, let me start with you. Can you tell us specifically what are your concerns with this new production of Evita? Yes, there are no principal actors who are Latinx, but tell us what your concerns are.
Well, generally, you know, my concern isn't just with this production. This is just one small symptom of a larger illness. And the issue is that so often stories featuring people that are from underrepresented populations don't get to feature performers from those populations. And as a result, you know, actors doing their best, but not necessarily having a deep understanding of that population can end up unintentionally bringing stereotypes and shallow sort of depictions to the stage and to the screen as well. And it's a much larger problem than just one production. And the fact is that, you know, growing up in this country, you know, brown kids watch TV every day and see white faces and learn to empathize with white faces. And white children growing up in this country don't have an equal opportunity to learn to empathize with brown faces. And as a result, we end up in a society where we're vulnerable to demagogues coming in and saying things like these brown people are rapers and thieves and we should get rid of them. And so it's a much larger issue because if we had more practice as a society learning to empathize with people that don't look like us and that do not share all of our cultural experiences, then we learn to be accepting of them.
So, but let me just,
right now, it's a very scary.
Yeah, if I can just jump in here. I mean, I completely hear what you're saying. But this larger issue right now is coming to bear on the North Shore Music Theater. I mean, as I said earlier, there's a protest being planned there. I just want to be sure I'm understanding, you know, sort of a subset of what you're saying here. Is it that you are also, in addition, concerned that, you know, for a role like Eva Perón, that a non-Latina actor can't bring the same, I don't know, knowledgeable authenticity or expertise or artistic expression to that role because of a lack of experience and cultural intuition, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, that is more or less what I'm saying. And I would beg the question, you know, if you were producing a play about Rosa Parks, would you cast a non-black actress in the role and say, well, she's an actor, she can do the research and she can understand that culture? Or would you recognize that that would be problematic to have someone who didn't understand that culture depict that character?
Well, since Bill Haney is here with us, he's the owner of the North Shore Music Theater, let me turn that question to you. So, Bill, who did you end up casting? And you know, answer Lauren's question. Do you think that she's capable of doing the same job, as authentic a job on stage as a Latina actor could?
Well, absolutely. We always, when I cast my shows, unless it's specifically like Dreamgirls or shows of that type, we have to, as she just pointed out, Rosa Parks. That's a whole different story. To do a show like...
How is that different?
Because Evita was played by Patti LuPone on Broadway, and I don't think she's...
There's a lot of things that we did in the 70s that we don't do anymore.
Well, and I'm not the only one in the country that's doing this, or actually the plan. I know there's a production being planned in Australia with a non-Latino cast. We have several, by the way, including... Pardon me?
Well, if we could just let him let him finish, I will absolutely turn back to you, Lauren.
We have... number one, we're never allowed by labor laws and equity rules to ask somebody's religion, their background, their ethnicity.
Absolutely.
None of that is allowed. We go when I go to cast, again, a non-specific Dreamgirls show like that, I look for the best in talent. We, in this case, our casting directors in New York, they sent a special notice. We send a really wide range. You have to, if you're an actor, you know we're casting. And they specifically put, we're looking for Latinx people to come in. We'd love to put those folks in the show. I can't drag them out of their homes.
How many people did audition?
We see anywhere between 3,000 and 4,000 people in the 5 days.
And out of all those people, there wasn't a phenomenal Latina actor?
We have a bunch of Latino actors in my show, including one principal. I'm not going to give names today because I just don't want to do this to our actors. But I know for a fact, because since this all came up, we had to do a little research as best we could guess. A lot of them came to us and said, by the way, we're reading this stuff. I'm Latino. I'm this. I'm that. And then North Shore actually won awards before I bought it. It won an award for a diverse casting theater. In my shows this year alone, I do what I'm calling colorblind casting. We had an African American, a Cogsworth in Beauty and the Beast. I had a little person as LeFou. We had the little kid that plays the teapot is Asian. I had an Asian Gaston. So we do it. I pick the best talent, unless it's a specific piece that has to be something special. I pick the best talent.
And you don't think Evita is specific?
She's not specific. I don't think I did enough.
Why do you not think she's specific?
Because I think that the whole point of this story is her rise to power and her climb up the ladder. And again, we'll go back to the 70s when the show was created.
To her country?
Well, so Lauren, on that point, let me ask you. I feel like that there is a great degree of, in Central and South America, in the Latin world in general, a remarkable multidimensional kind of diversity there, right?
Mm-hmm. There is.
I mean, we have the incredible racial diversity, cultural diversity. And so I feel like, isn't there the risk of sort of reducing that diversity down to really simplistic measures? And here's why I ask, because Eva Perón did have some European ancestry, and as do many people from Argentina. and even right. around major parts of Latin America. But I just want to ask
because
hang on for a second. Hang on. I promise you, I'll let you talk. But because I want to play a little bit of tape for you and then have you respond to this because our arts reporter Maria Garcia spoke with Diego Arciniegas. He's a senior lecturer at theater studies at Wellesley College about this question of ancestry of Eva Perón and how that should be represented on stage. And here's what he said.
The folks specifically, the central characters in Evita Perón, Juan Perón, and Che Guevara were ethnically pretty European. And so while I understand the intention that actors of color should be considered, if this is a biographical musical, then it is completely appropriate in both senses of the word to cast them that way.
So, Lauren, what's your thought about that?
My thought is I agree that ethnically, yes, they have European heritage, as do most people of Latin descent in all of Latin America. But most people in Latin America are not just European. They have heritage coming from Africa and from the indigenous peoples. And the thing that unites them, regardless of their ethnicity, is their culture. So I pose the question, because I am not ethnically American, because my mother was not born here, does that mean I'm not American? Because that's kind of the argument I hear people making about European descendant Latin people, that just because they have European heritage, it negates the culture that they grew up with. There's a difference between ethnicity and culture. I'm currently doing a production of In the Heights in Minnesota, and we have a cast that is all Latin, that are every color under the sun, and they're is a lovely young actress who's playing Vanessa for us right now, who has naturally very fair skin and naturally red hair and green eyes, and most of her family lives in Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. And when she got cast in this show, she assumed they were going to put her in a wig, because most of the time when she gets cast to play Latin characters, they say, oh, well, actually, you don't look Latin enough, which is absurd, because she is Latin. And so when they told her in this production that she was going to get to wear her own hair, she nearly cried. Because it's been so long that she's not been able to represent who she is looking the way she does. And there are plenty of Latin actors with a lot of European heritage that feel the same way that she does.
Hmm. Bill, I mean, respond to that. You're putting this production on. What do you think?
Well, as I said earlier, when I went into the cast this show, I wasn't looking for any specific person. We invited Latinos to come in, but Eva Perón could be, as we said earlier, it could be almost anything. And again, I cast the best people to put our productions on.
But you hear what Lauren's saying about that she's making the argument that in order to she's making two arguments. One of them is that in order to produce the most authentic and compelling representation of Eva Perón on the stage, that person needs to have, in Lauren's words, a deep cultural connection to the country and the culture and the circumstances that Eva Perón represents and lives through.
Well, we kind of don't ask that in auditions as we're going through 3,000 people. We really have to narrow it down.
Well, just let him finish, then I'll turn right back to you.
We narrow it down to the what we consider the best people to do our show, and this show specifically didn't, you know, in my opinion, in our entire team's opinion, it didn't have to be, it would have been great if it was, but it didn't have to be Latinx. It didn't have to be. We have a bunch that we found out, as I said, after the fact, because what DeLauren just said, we don't know from somebody's name, because one gal that came to us said, I know my name is Jones, but I happen to be half this and half that, but my mother married this, you know? And I said, okay, and that makes my job a lot easier, when I really don't have to check out people's names and what their background is and go through their whole history of their life. We just want them to do a great show, and that's what we actually, I think, believe cast in this show, including all types of different folks.
Mm. Lauren, go ahead.
Yeah, so first of all, the most important thing that I need to just mention, you said you don't think that it matters for the show, and again, I think it does. But secondly, I'd like to say that I absolutely acknowledge that he's not allowed to ask. It's a legal situation. An audition, even though it's a weird type of job interview, is in fact, legally speaking, a job interview. And so, yes, he's correct. It shouldn't be his job to need to investigate anyone's self-identification or how they, represent themselves. In fact, I do feel like casting directors and directors are sort of being asked to complete a task with their hands tied behind their back and wearing a blindfold. That's part of why my initiative, Project Am I Right, focuses on actor-to-actor conversations, because I think that it's an unfair burden to put on a director. I think that an unfair burden has been put on you, Bill. I really do. I think that it has to be up to the actors to know who they are, to know how who they are reflects on stage, and to know how that affects their coworkers, and to act with compassion.
So, Lauren, there's something that's been sort of nagging at me here, and let's see if I can sort of phrase this in the right way. Sometimes my thinking out loud isn't too clear, but give me a second here. What is the logical conclusion for what you're saying, which is, you know, that really we need to bring people with profound cultural, historical connections to these roles and cast them in these roles? Because is the logical conclusion then that a production like Hamilton would have never happened, because that's a bunch of revolutionary era white guys that was played by right. a spectacularly multicultural yeah. cast?
We can kiss
Absolutely.
The show cats
so,
goodbye in this whole theory also.
That comes out a lot. And I'd like to point out that there's a really big difference between what Bill was talking about, which is color blind casting and how he approaches things, and what's called color conscious casting. And I believe that's what Hamilton is. So the idea is that Hamilton cast purposely all actors of color to play characters that they're very well aware were not people of color, because it makes a point. They do it to make a statement. It's taking history and turning it on its head. And colorblind casting is, you know, like you said, it can also be productive because it can employ actors of color who don't get as many jobs. But it can also end up being problematic. For example, if we pretend that we don't see race at all, which I think is disingenuous and unrealistic, and we cast a show like Oklahoma, let's say, and we cast a white man as Curly and a black man as Judd. If you don't know the story, Curly's the hero, Judd is the villain. And there's a scene where Curly tells Judd he should hang himself and reenacts that act. Now, if you have a white hero telling a black villain right. to hang himself and reenacting it, that can suddenly get very uncomfortable. And if we don't, ignore the fact that that's happening, then we can end up saying, well, we thought we were doing the right thing because we wanted to give an actor a job because he was the best for the role. And it's like, I understand that intention, and I understand that it's great that he had that role, but you're also putting something very tricky up on a stage and pretending that it's not tricky.
Right. You know, I'm
not a proponent. I was just saying, I prefer color conscious casting to colorblind. That's all.
Okay. Yeah. And I didn't mean to jump in there, but I'm conscious of the time that we've had. This has been a really fascinating conversation, but I do want to give Bill a chance to have a word here before I got to wrap up.
As I said, we went in with open eyes. A lot of people came in to see us. We chose who we thought were the best for the role. And I invite everybody to come see the show and judge for themselves. I think we did a pretty good job what we put together. And that's all I can do at this point, because we tried, and I think we succeeded.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I have to say I am very grateful to both of you for coming and having this conversation with us today, because, we continue to try as a country. I mean, Lauren, to what you were saying, and Bill, for what you were both saying earlier, we're in a time and a place where we all need to continue to try to move forward together. So
Absolutely.
Lauren Viegas, founder of the project Am I Right, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Bill Haney, owner of the North Shore Music Theater and producer of its new production of Evita, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, let us know what you think about this. Send us your comments at radioboston.org. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Dick Lehr joins us now in the studio. You know him as an award-winning former reporter for the Boston Globe and author of many books, including Black Mass. He's also a professor of journalism at Boston University. And now he's out with his first young adult novel. It's called Trell. And it's the fictionalized version of a very real and tragic murder that happened in Roxbury in 1988 and a wrongful conviction that followed. And Dick Lehrer is with us here. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Magda.
Hey, so before we get to the book and the YA novel, I'm wondering if you could just remind us what happened in 1988, the true crime and the murder of Darlene Tiffany Moore.
Sure. In the summer of 1988, it was August, and it was this is a period when crack cocaine was flourishing. A lot of violence in this city and in other cities. It was the same in New York City. The Central Park jogger case had come down. So in a lot of sense, people are in pins and needles and whatnot. And on an August summer night, Tiffany Moore was hanging out on the corner of Humboldt Ave in Roxbury, which is as some call Heroin Alley, and Homestead Street, with some friends. She'd been away for most of the summer. Her family had sent her away, concerned about all the violence in the city. And she'd come back. She was hanging out with friends. And she was at the wrong place at the wrong time. There was a street gangs were having a beef, and some gunmen came up and started shooting while she was sitting on the blue mailbox, swinging her legs and whatnot. And they didn't hit their intended target, and instead they hit Tiffany Moore. Yeah. And at the time, what was such an uproar was she was 12, and she was the youngest victim of street gang violence mm-hmm. in the city's history. Sadly, there have been younger victims since, but you can imagine the uproar at the time.
Yeah, I mean, people wanted justice for this poor girl.
Absolutely, and it also seemed to be the culmination of a summer of violence and sort of mayhem, and there are even people in the neighborhood saying, we need the National Guard. It's more than the Boston PD can handle.
Yeah, I mean, but then Sean Drumgold ends up being wrongfully convicted.
Sure.
I mean, how did that happen?
Well, there was, as you just mentioned, there was a demand for justice for Tiffany. There was a huge manhunt in the city, and there was police and the government were under a lot of pressure to solve this crime. And within a couple of weeks, they picked up Sean, a young drug dealer named Sean Drumgold, and a friend, and they were arrested and charged with killing Tiffany Moore.
Wow.
Yeah,
and he was convicted of life. He was sentenced to life in prison.
A year later, there was a murder trial of Drumgold, and he was convicted life without the possibility of parole, which is a death sentence. And I have to say, I remember, I was not covering it, the crime at the time. I was on the Spotlight team.
Yeah.
But I think I felt what I think a lot of people did. There was a sigh of relief. Oh, good, they caught Tiffany's killer. Justice is served.
Mm-hmm.
But then it wasn't.
Yeah, but later on, you did through the Spotlight team, right? You covered the terms of his conviction, and that led to it being overturned.
Right. Then we fast forward 14 years later to 2003. I reinvestigated it for the Globe, and did develop evidence that witnesses had been coerced, and he was wrongfully convicted, and led to court hearings. And in November of 2003, I think it was. He was sent home.
So the first and most obvious question that comes to mind, Dick, is that this story, the truth of this story is so searing.
Yeah.
Why retell it as a YA novel?
Well, I'd written about it for an adult audience already in the pages of the Boston Globe. And one of the things, a couple of things came together a couple of years ago, why I undertook the novelization, a novel approach, was that something had stayed with me all these years when I did the original investigation in the early 2000s. And that was, although my focus was journalistic and on coerced testimony and all that, I learned a little bit about Drumgold's family. And I learned that when he was arrested in 1988, he had a newborn baby girl, a daughter named Kiara. And she had grown up with these marking time with regular prison visits, to her father. And I learned that she regularly, if not always, said goodbye with the line, "Daddy, when you coming home?" And that always stayed with me. And so a couple of years ago, you mentioned Black Mass. It was after the movie came out and I had some space, and I'd been turning it over in my head. It's like, what about writing for, about these same issues? I see issues in all these stories as a journalist, justice and injustice, and also journalism, the power of journalism. what if I, you know, try to find a younger audience for these, since the stories had already appeared for an adult audience, that sort of resonates with those issues? And I started thinking about, what if the girl's a protagonist? You know, what if she teams up with a reporter from the Boston Globe, and together they, you know, they solve this in terms of looking for evidence to show that her father, Romero Taylor, was wrongfully convicted. And so that was the push. It was like, you know, trying to find a new audience for the same kinds of things we write about in the Globe.
So this is Van Trell Taylor.
Van Trell Taylor is the central
character in the book.
Which is why it's called Trell, because everyone calls her Trell.
Yeah. Just, actually, I should ask, obviously, did you talk to Sean Drumgold before you wrote this about, would he be okay with this?
He sent me a whole bunch of texts saying he is, yeah, because, you know, I did show him the manuscript. Met with him last spring, and also his attorney of many years, Rosemary Scapiccio. I ran it by them.
Okay.
And it was interesting exchange, because on the one hand, he certainly recognized things in the novel, but on the other hand, it's a novel. I mean, there's so much imagined and made up, you know, so.
So I would love if you could read an excerpt from Trell for us, because I just would love to give folks a taste as to how you've done this.
Okay, sure, yeah. Well, let's just start at the beginning. This is at the crack of dawn on a Saturday morning, when Trell and her mom are climbing aboard a bus that's owned by another character from the neighborhood named Big Vinny. Who has put together, bought himself an old heap and fixed it up to give folks like Trell and her mom, Shay, a ride for a regular visit. So I'll just jump in right there. When I dropped into my seat by the window, the morning sun was so blinding I could barely see. I heard Big Finney up front calling out again, "Morning, Glory," his laughter breaking from him like a big wave rolling across a body of water. The bus jerked forward, and a triple-decker outside the window on my left came between the slanted sun and me, meaning I could open my eyes. Just about everybody who usually takes Big Vinny's bus ride, was on board. Ma was already talking to Marlon Williams' mother, catching up on their week, with Ma asking if Marlon's great-aunt was feeling any better after the bad fall she'd taken down her cellar stairs. Terrence Jones's grandmother was in the front seat, and today she had brought along Terrence's three younger siblings. I overheard them talking about Terrence's birthday being next Tuesday. He was turning 27. My daddy's birthday was coming up too, next month in July. He'd be 35. The bus seated 20 passengers, and every seat was filled with people like Ma and me, Marlon's mother, and Terrence's grandmother. We were like family, because riding together these many months, years even, we'd all gotten to know one another pretty well, where everyone lived, and who was who in their extended families, and certainly the reasons why we were Big Vinny's regulars. We were all taking the 90-minute ride south of Boston to visit fathers and brothers and uncles in our lives, or, more accurately, missing from our lives. Walpole was our destination. It's the nickname for the state's maximum security prison. It's where Marlon Williams is doing 12 for armed robbery, where Terrence Jones is doing 10 for drug dealing or, quote, possession with intent to distribute, language I wish I didn't know. My daddy, Romero Taylor, Walpole is where he's in prison for murder, where he is sentenced for life without the possibility for parole. Except for one thing, I know he didn't do it.
That's Dick Lehrer reading from his new YA novel, Trell. Just in the segment before you came in, Dick, we had this conversation about theater and casting actors of color in roles that are about the lives of people of color. And it's interesting because here now I'm talking to you.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you're a veteran, celebrated Boston journalist, but you've written a YA novel in the voice of a young African-American girl.
Yeah, 14-year-old black girl from Roxbury.
Is there...
Who would think?
Right? Is there a concern about, you know, appropriation, authenticity? I mean, the ability for you to capture that voice in the best way possible?
Well, some may question that. What my thinking is, or I was thinking and do think, that given all the years of reporting I've done in the city, in Roxbury and Dorchester, doing all the interviews, covering not only the Sean Drumgold Tiffany murder case, but so many others, interviewing kids and cops and parents and killers and whatnot, that I think my thinking was, if you combine all that research and reporting with imagination, that I that's how I created, you know, what I hope to be a credible 14-year-old girl from Roxbury. And then the other thing that I thought a lot about this going into it. The other thing is that this is a suspenseful, plot-driven novel. It's not what can be others, you know, other types of novels, which are deeply introspective, coming of age. I'm not sure I could have gone there. Other writers could, I think, but I wanted, you know, this is about a young girl on a crusade, a protagonist on a crusade for justice, who teams up with a journalist, and it, I think, showcases the power of journalism and determination.
Yeah. Well, Dick Lehr is a professor of journalism at Boston University. He's an award-winning reporter and author of many books, including Black Mass. His new YA novel that we've been talking about is called Trell. He'll be at the Brookline Booksmith tomorrow night talking about it. We've got lots of information about that at radioboston.org. Dick Lehr, it is always so terrific to have you. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. It's good to be here.
And congratulations
nice to
on
see
the
you
book.
Again.
Yeah. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.